You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio and online at kpfa.org. My name is Sasha Lilly. She's become the patron saint for women artists, as well as for many people with disabilities, Chicanas and Latinas, gay men and others. I'm speaking, of course, of the Mexican communist artist Frida Kahlo, who died 55 years ago in 1954, yet shot to fame in the past two decades. She's been alternately embraced as a Mexican nationalist, bisexual, feminist, and radical transgressor of postmodern boundaries. Frida styles, clothes, look-alike contests, and kitsch abound. Madonna says she identifies with her, while the Hollywood film Frida, starring Salma Hayek, popularized the story of the heroic but pained Mexican artist whose passion for life overcame her disability and the infidelities of her husband, the muralist Diego Rivera. But what about the politics of Frida Kahlo and her times, which seem to have been lost in the midst of Frida mania? And why has this complicated artist become almost a brand name? Margaret A. Lindauer is professor of art history at Virginia Commonwealth University and is the author of Devouring Frida, The Art History and Popular Celebrity of Frida Kahlo, published by Wesleyan University Press. Today we present an encore broadcast of an interview I did with Dr. Lindauer about her book, which I commenced by asking her who Frida Kahlo was.
She was born in 1907 to a fairly well-to-do family, and her father actually was a photographer for the Diaz presidential administration. And she enjoyed all of the sort of luxuries of middle-class life until the Mexican Revolution, and also until a tragic bus trolley car accident in which she suffered really horrific injuries that caused lifelong complications, physical complications, sort of threw her off track of this sort of middle-class success that she would have otherwise had. And she then married Diego Rivera, and that's how she first became known, was as the wife of Diego Rivera. And she was considered at first to be sort of a painter hobbyist who portrayed her own tragedies and tribulations of her life in her paintings. But she was also known as a member of the Communist Party. But even that was sort of cast as something that she did to please her husband in many ways. She became famous in her husband's shadow, as her husband's shadow. She did things according to the first version of her life in order to please her husband. She, as I said, she suffered lifelong complications from the accident, and so she also is known as a person who suffered great pain, but also sort of was able to create a body of work despite this pain. But eventually the pain and the physical problems overcame her, and she died in 1954. Some people say that it was suicide, as a sort of an extension of that sort of emotional turbulence of her life, and others attribute it to more to the physical complications.
Well, you mentioned Diego Rivera. Obviously, Frida Kahlo is a whole lot more than her husband's wife. But
right.
For those who don't know who he is, could you talk a little bit about the muralist?
Yeah, he was one of what has been called the great muralists of Mexico, who became famous during the post-revolutionary era for painting murals in public buildings. They were hired by the governmental administrations, mostly as a sort of education campaign. One of the issues that the revolution brought to the forefront was the great disparity between rich and poor, educated and uneducated, rural and urban populations. And so during the post-revolutionary reforms, one interest was in how to educate this huge population of uneducated people. And one solution was to, in a sense, put an illustrated history of Mexico on public walls and in public murals. So that's how he became famous. Now, that mural movement was short-lived, mostly because the politics of Mexico changed, and Diego Rivera went on to paint private commissions within the United States, and he had several individual patrons, and he worked for Rockefeller, for instance, and he worked for the Ford industry. So he really did gain this international reputation as an artist during his own lifetime, whereas Frida Kahlo became much more well-known after her death.
Well, maybe you can talk just a little bit about the Mexican Revolution, since it was so formative for the work of Frida Kahlo and Diego Rivera. Can you just give us just a little bit of background about it, and then about the post-revolutionary policies of José Vasconcelos?
Sure. The revolution started actually as a campaign slogan. Francisco Madero, who was campaigning against Porfirio Diaz, came up with a campaign slogan of effective suffrage, no re-election. And basically, he was campaigning against the fact that Diaz had been president for 35 years and that there was an incredible amount of power and wealth concentrated in Diaz and in a very small circle of people, and that that wasn't good for the country. Now, what started out as a simple campaign slogan actually coalesced a lot of diverse groups of people into a campaign against what had been the ruling party. And one of the, there were several issues, and some of them I've already mentioned, the disparity between rich and poor, the indigenous population and the Mexicans of European descent, the disparity between the rural and urban populations. And So the revolution was sort of brought all of these different groups together to fight against the immediate past and how much national wealth was actually also going to individuals in Europe and in the United States. Now, the revolution lasted for 10 years. It was an incredibly unstable decade of great violence, great economic uncertainty, great national uncertainty. And even after the revolution was over, there continued to be a great deal of social instability. I mean, presidents were elected and they held office for usually not their entire terms because there was so much difference among those groups that had first come together in the revolution, after the revolution, in post-revolutionary Mexico. There was debate over, well, should there be concentration on reforming the nation in terms of addressing these disparities between the rich and poor and the literate and illiterate and the indigenous and European populations or populations of European descent? Should there be great social reform, or should it focus more on reconstruction, getting the national economy back in line, getting industry back up, getting an infrastructure back up? And so during the post-revolutionary decades, really, which it's hard to put in sort of end point on them, but clearly they ran from 1920 to the early 1940s, there were different philosophies that came into power during different presidential administrations. So even post-revolutionary Mexico was a socially unstable time, though not nearly as violent. And so I look at a lot of Frida Kahlo's paintings as reflecting some of those debates that were occurring during the post-revolutionary time.
Let's talk about the biographies of Frida Kahlo, which you take issue with in your book, Devouring Frida.
Mm-hmm.
How does Frida Kahlo's work tend to be characterized in these?
What I found when I first started reading biographies of Frida Kahlo, which were the first one was published in the late 1980s, and there were several shorter versions published shortly thereafter, and they really focus on the artist's private life, and they look at her paintings as illustrations of her life. And so there's almost like a one-to-one correspondence, where in 1929, for example, she and Diego Rivera were married, and so then their biographers have looked at the painting that she created shortly after that called Frida and Diego Rivera and said, oh, that's a wedding portrait, and that's about her marriage. And then she had a miscarriage another year, and so the painting that was produced that year is considered to be about the miscarriage. Her husband had an affair another year, and so the painting is considered to be about the affair. And so there's this intense focus on the events of her private life and on the events of her love life. And so the idea that she was a person who was living in a complex social political time, and that she was an artist who had some thoughts about those times, was completely overlooked. It's as if it wasn't even considered.
Well, let's talk about some of those takes on her work. In your book, you point to a number of contradictions you see around this idea that one of the most devastating events that happened in Frida Kahlo's life was her inability to bear children.
Right.
And she painted a painting in 1932 called Henry Ford Hospital After a Miscarriage, mm-hmm. and that's used to reinforce this claim. Maybe you could describe the painting for us and tell us why you have problems with this perspective.
Sure. It's actually a pretty eerie painting. The artist has depicted herself lying down on a hospital bed, and we know it's a hospital bed because it says Henry Ford Hospital right along the side of it, and Detroit right along the side of it. But this bed itself is situated outdoors in this very bleak, desolate landscape. There are no plants or trees or any signs of life, but in the distance, we can see the Ford plant, industrial plant in the background, very, very small. And so there's this strange juxtaposition of this hospital bed in the foreground and this industrial plant in the background. And she's lying naked on the bed, and the sheets are covered in blood. Her belly is still swollen from her pregnancy. And she surrounds the bed with six objects that are tied together with, each one has a red ribbon tied to it, and then she holds a group of those red ribbons, so they all sort of direct back down to her. And three of them are really sort of these medical references. One of them is a three-dimensional model of a torso. Another is a sort of skeletal model of pelvic bones. And another is an autoclave, or an instrument for sterilizing surgical instruments. And so it's this very sort of clinical references to being in the hospital and to investigating a cause of a miscarriage or for treating the event of the miscarriage. And then there are also there's a snail up in the right upper right-hand corner and an orchid in the center of the painting situated slightly below the bed. And those look like references, sexual references, with the snail being this long sort of phallic, although flaccid, but phallic image, and then the orchid a reference to female genitalia. And so there's this reference to sexuality, which is a very sort of not very romantic take on motherhood. It's more of a biological take, again. And then in the right above the bed is the what would be the aborted fetus, but she wasn't far enough along in her miscarriage for the fetus to be as fully developed as what she has depicted here. But so although she has a very large tear on her face, it's a very sort of matter-of-fact depiction. This is, you know, through the sexual act, one gets pregnant, and through these medical investigations, one determines how or why someone has a miscarriage. But the thing that I find so jarring about this painting is, as I said, the placement in the this landscape. That in a sense, it puts the very notion, this event, the fact that she had a miscarriage, it puts it out for public scrutiny. It's not a private event. It's not a domestic event. It's not an emotional event. Although it is, of course, all of those things, it's not only those things. It's also an event that is subject to public scrutiny over what happened, why it happened, and was the artist herself to blame? And very often in biographies, there are biographers list several reasons or things that the artist did in order to bring about the miscarriage herself. And so she's sort of blamed for it. Now, also in the letters that have been published, Frida Kahlo's letters, when she writes to her doctors about, she first finds out that she's pregnant, and she writes to her doctors about her concerns, and they're not romantic, they're not emotional letters, they're very, very practical concerns. The fact that she and her husband travel quite a bit, that they're not really interested in having children, it would really complicate their lifestyles, and that her husband, in fact, wasn't really all that keen on having another child. He already had children in a previous marriage. So in looking at the painting itself, alongside some of these letters, there's really not any evidence that she was painting this for this sort of emotional catharsis, purging her disappointment and despair over not having children.
And so this is a real contrast with the way that her biographers view this event. So why do you think they concluded that she was devastated from this?
Well, in post-revolutionary Mexico, as I said, there was such social instability that the family became a really potent symbol of how the nation would become more stable. Women were expected to have children. Now, during the revolution, there were women who were fighting on, they were engaged in violent battles. And so there was a lot of blurring of gendered boundaries. And the emphasis on the family was, this, in a sense, it reestablished those boundaries. And it created clear roles for men and women. The man was to be the father, the head of the family. The woman was to serve his needs. And one of those greatest needs was to perpetuate the family, which meant having children. And within post-revolutionary Mexico, there were novels and popular films that celebrated this very, very rich, potent symbol of how the stable family would represent the future of a stable nation.
These biographies are also based on some of the recollections of friends of Frida Kahlo about the significance of the miscarriage and so on. And so are you saying that these recollections were filtered through the lens of the times and this emphasis on the family?
That's right. I mean, several biographers interviewed people who knew Frida Kahlo during her life, and there's testimony that, oh, yes, she was devastated over her miscarriages, and undoubtedly she was. Anybody would be. It's not like, I'm not saying that it was a non-event in her life, but I do emphasize that because it was such a potent social symbol that, of course, there was an assumption that women should have children, and that especially a married woman who did not have children would therefore be devastated. There was such social pressure and such social expectation that I think that any biographer has to be careful when interviewing people who knew the subject of those biographies, to be careful to understand where there's a separation between the social expectations of the time that become so internalized among people who live during those times that they'd get projected onto other people. And so, yes, people who knew Frida Kahlo may recall that she was emotionally distraught after having a miscarriage, but they may have overread her desire to have children. I don't think that her paintings indicate that. I don't think she was painting about the desire to have children. Let me put it that way. I think she was painting about the fact that there was so much public attention put on the fact that she did not have children, and that the biographers who found people who corroborated that, I guess that's how I would interpret what people may have said, is that those references to her desire also may be evidence of that social context in which she was painting, and which I think she illustrated much more than she illustrated her own emotions.
Well, talk a little bit about this gender shift that happened after the Mexican Revolution. You have an interesting discussion in your book about one of the murals by Diego Rivera that depict the soldaderas, the women soldiers who fought in the Mexican Revolution and in the post-revolutionary period, their status has sort of changed. Can you describe that mural?
Right. It's as if history gets rewritten. Instead of having women who are engaged in any kind of physical battle, his mural portrays women, including Frida Kahlo, as sort of assistants to the soldiers, handing the soldiers the guns. So they weren't there in the front lines. They were there sort of in the same way that they were expected to be there in the post-revolutionary times in support of the masculine endeavors and as a sort of secondary role. And the way that some of those the accounts of the revolution have been written, even the soldaderas they're even talked about as bringing lunch to their lovers or husbands as those men were engaged in battle. So it gets rewritten as a very stereotypically feminine role.
Let's talk a little more about the ideology of the post-revolutionary period in Mexico. Mm-hmm. Particularly, let's talk about Mexican nationalism. In your book, you discuss Arielism. Can you explain what that is and how it was influenced by Mexican nationalism?
Sure. It actually refers to a poem by Uruguayan poet Jose Enrique Rudo, who it sort of developed into a movement of Arielism. It basically romanticizes pre-Columbian cultures, and it holds up those pre-Columbian cultures as an ideal, pure Mexico. But it also, ironically, in its idealization of pre-Columbian Mexico, it also casts those cultures as innocent. And so there's sort of this contradiction among the Arielists where the indigenous people still need help from the middle class, for example, because they are still innocent and there's this romantic sense of purity. Now, that notion of Arielism, that was sort of one aspect, or let me rephrase. There were several nationalisms where we get this idea that post-revolutionary Mexico can be characterized in terms of a very nationalistic era. And what often gets lost in that is that there are several versions of nationalism and competing nationalisms. And among the Mexican muralists that I referred to earlier, Rivera is often characterized as subscribing to that more romantic nationalism. He considered himself to be a comrade of the common people, or comrade to the common people, and he idealized indigenous cultural histories. And another one of the Mexican muralists, Siqueiros, he was really wary of that sort of romanticization. And he argued that the nation really needed to look more to the future and to acknowledge that it had this more recent past, that it was an industrial past and a capitalist past, and that to deny that was not going to help in an economic recovery during the post-revolutionary era. And, of course, Frida Kahlo was another painter who was creating works during that time and during these ideas of these competing ideas of nationalism. And what histories or what aspects of a very complicated and intercultural past of Mexico ought to be put sort of center stage as the country was working on reconstruction?
Well, it tends to be assumed by Frida Kahlo's biographers that her ideas were similar to that of her husband, Diego Rivera, which you don't agree with. Can you talk about why you think that is? And maybe you can tell us a bit about the painting My Dress Hangs Here, which Kahlo created in 1933.
Sure. First of all, yes, many biographers have characterized Kahlo's politics as simply the same as her husband's, or maybe even merely parroting her husband's. But others have also suggested that the politics, that she didn't really even subscribe to those politics that fiercely, that she wore a Taiwan dress mostly to please her husband, not because it represented her own political ideas.
And that's the indigenous costume of women from Tehuantepec.
That's right, which historically was a matriarchal society. And during immediately after the revolution, several women wore this dress. It was highly fashionable. And after that trend sort of died down, Frida Kahlo continued to wear the dress, and she has sort of become known by the dress. You know, the dress becomes a symbol of Frida Kahlo herself. And the painting, My Dress Hangs There, she has this Taiwan dress in the very center of the painting. And one of the aspects of the romanticizing of the pre-Columbian cultures that Rivera promoted in some of his paintings, one aspect of that is that the idealization that the Mexican culture is better than the U.S. culture. I should explain that the place where her dress hangs in this painting is New York City. There's the Statue of Liberty can be seen in the foreground. There's references to Wall Street. There's the Trinity Church that is very close to the stock market in Lower Manhattan. It's sort of this condensed collage approach to depicting New York City. And her dress hangs there in the middle, and there's two columns that come up from the ground, and on one column is a trophy, and on the top of the other column is a toilet. And there's a blue ribbon that is tied from the toilet to the trophy, and her dress hangs in between that. And the painting itself is very, very dense, and it even includes some actual collage work. There's cutouts from newspapers of crowds, mostly people standing in lines or in sports stadiums or just in masses of people. And those crowds sort of emanate from the bottom of this dress, as if the dress is giving birth to these masses of people. And there's all kinds of references in the painting to economic corruption and to sort of cultural degradation. There's a garbage can, for example, but there's a human hand in there and entrails. And you know, then there's a ribbon also that is connecting the church, which its stained glass has a dollar sign in it. I mean, that's a pretty blatant statement that no aspect of society is immune from financial corruption. And the fact that her dress hangs there, it doesn't hang apart from it. It's very much within it. In this painting, she's making a statement that this symbol of Mexico that has become known as a symbol of her, the symbol of Mexico, it sort of gives the false idea that Mexico is that if you look to the pre-Columbian past, then you look to an era that is not corrupt, but that Mexico is equally corrupt as the United States and is equally susceptible to the political and cultural and financial ills of that supposedly the romantics looking to pre-Columbian culture say can be undone by looking to that pre-Columbian past as a model for the future.
And that's a very different reading, isn't it, than the conventional reading of the painting, which is just where Kahlo is seen to just be saying the U.S. is corrupt and Mexico is where things are genuine.
That's right. And another aspect of the conventional reading of the painting is that it represents that she was homesick, that she portrayed such an ugly portrait of New York because she really didn't want to be in New York. It was painted at a time when she and her husband were living in New York, and that she didn't want to be there. She wanted to be back in Mexico. And so that's how it has been interpreted, and I see that there isn't that clear distinction between the difference between Mexico and the United States because this corruption is so closely associated with this symbol of Mexico.
Well, you mentioned that there was not just one nationalism in Mexico and that it was a dynamic ideology. Talk about this painting, For Inhabitants of Mexico. It was painted in 1938 during a period when the left nationalist president Lázaro Cárdenas was in power. He nationalized Mexico's petroleum and put forward a number of nationalist ideas. Can you start by talking about the Cárdenas period and then how For Inhabitants of Mexico comments on it?
Yeah, it's kind of an ironic coincidence that the painting comes from 1938, because Cárdenas was considered to be sort of a return to the post-revolutionary concerns for the social and economic disparities within Mexico. And he initiated more social programs and social reform that addressed the laborers and indigenous people than previous administrations had done. And so there was, among those people who looked at the post-revolutionary era as looked for a need for reform rather than mere reconstruction, there was a sense that Cárdenas had returned to that and returned to the true post-revolutionary, or what it ought to have been. And yet, here is Frida Kahlo producing this painting in 1938 that does not give us this sense of optimism. In fact, it's a very pessimistic depiction of symbols of Mexico, or of things that are considered to be quintessentially Mexican. The painting itself is called The Four Inhabitants, but there are actually five figures that are across the painting from left to right. There's a very large papier-mâché Judas figure that is associated with the Easter celebration. And next to him, very, very small little girl seated on the ground, dressed in a Tijuana dress. And then next to her, a much, much larger Nayarit or pre-Columbian sculpture made out of clay. And then next to that is a skeleton associated with the Day of the Dead. And next to that, but slightly behind those other four, is a piñata that is it's a Zapatista piñata. And each of these symbols does not really, well, none of them really suggest optimism or authority or power or in terms of looking to the future. In fact, in the background of the painting, the buildings in the background are very, very small. And on the right side of the composition, one of the paintings is on fire. And you can see very small figures, people all running to put out this fire. And these four or five figures towards the front of the painting, they're completely oblivious to this disaster that's happening in the background, as if there's this disconnect that, yes, we might have come up with these symbols, these visual representations that celebrate Mexican culture, but these symbols are ill-equipped to address with the very real events and the potentially catastrophic events that are happening in the society in the background of the painting.